and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith, and I have one of the most exciting episodes of my life in front of me with some amazing folks around the table. One of those folks is not Sebastian. Now, regular listeners are going to be utterly devastated that his Franco-Ontarian tones won't be whispering in your ears, but we are out in Vancouver. And Sebastian is still shivering in minus 20 in the nation's capital. So we really hope you have a nice warm blanket. This is episode 100. We've been going for evidently a little while. And we are extremely excited to kind of take stock of where queer culture is in Canada, some of the big stories of the day, and then also maybe what we're facing moving forward. Now, I don't think I could ever put the right words in order to really give the credit that's due to the amazing folks around the table who is joining me today. So I'm going to invite them all to introduce themselves, and we'll kind of start with Katie.
Hi. So my name is Katie Sage. And I am I self-identify as an artist, curator, and I am an uninvited guest on these territories and on this land. And I also identify as non-binary, gender non-conforming.
Hi, I'm Madeline Taylor. I'm the programming director at CITR 101.9 FM, which broadcasts from the University of British Columbia, which is situated on unceded Musqueam territory. And I am a cis white settler living and working in Vancouver, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. Besides being a programming director, I do some freelancing and try to just soak up as much of the music subculture and queer subculture in Vancouver as I can.
Like a big sponge.
Mm-hmm. My name is JJ McCullough. I'm a columnist for the Washington Post. I write a weekly column on Canadian politics. I'm also a YouTuber. I've been doing weekly YouTube videos for about 3 years now. And just so everybody at home knows, I'm a white gay man. That's how I identify.
And I am Glenn Arthur. I am one of the co-hosts of Out and About in Canada, broadcasting from Vancouver on the Coast Salish, home of the Coast Salish peoples. I am a gay black man, and kind of being on the radio is kind of a part-time gig, but also a pretty cool way to connect with members of my community.
Absolutely. Now, what I am excited about in today's conversation is really looking at how the culture is different. Now, we talk a lot about doing this show, about things that happen across the country, and we read a lot of queer news out of that we find online, although it's really hard to find queer content in Canada that's particularly Canadian. It's like pulling teeth. But we realize, based out of Ottawa, that we don't really know what it's like to live in other places. I visited, and these places are really pretty, but I'm not there living, I'm not paying taxes, I'm not going to the laundromat, I'm not, engaging in day-to-day life. And I think we lose an element of what the reality is. So I know whether or not the idea of a queer cultural identity exists, or a Canadian queer cultural identity exists, and we're kind of lumped and painted with one homogenous brush across the whole country, but really all the folks in different areas are so distinctly different. Mm. I know, Katie, for example, you're over in Victoria, which is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to in my life. But what happens in your community is very, very different than folks over in Abbotsford, or you're in New Westminster, I believe.
That's right.
Folks in New Brunswick or other areas like that. And so, what do you think is distinct about queer culture within your community? And maybe what we can also start talking about is, do you think that there is a queer cultural identity? Like, or is it just a construct and a figment of our imagination?
I mean, as soon as you started kind of asking this question, I was thinking, I mean, this might be kind of like a sideline, but I was thinking about a conversation that I had with my friend Ray Spoon, and we've been talking about, like, as non-binary folks, we, in British Columbia, you're able to get your gender marker as an X, but the two of us are both from other places. So myself, I grew up on Anishinaabe territory, which is now called Peterborough, and you know, we both live in Victoria, and they're from Treaty 7 territory, Calgary, and you know, we both want to get these gender markers on our birth certificate and on our licenses, but because we're from other places, we can't do that because those provinces don't have that availability for us right now. So while we celebrate the fact that a lot of folks in British Columbia who are born there can do this thing, and that's like wonderful and exciting, we're both like, okay, there's still some more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. I think just picking up on that for a moment here, we know that I believe Ontario, before the Wynne government moved out, had to introduce legislation to allow for that,
mm-hmm.
Just for our Ontario listeners there.
Yeah.
And of course, the federal government under the Trudeau administration introduced the ability to change gender markers on passports and other federally regulated identification papers. And there's been a really interesting conversation happening at the National Chiefs of Police Association about developing a standard in how to consistently identify folks within the criminal justice recording system, which sounds really boring. But the reason why I mention this is that folks in Ottawa who are street involved, you know, in the downtown core, you know, you could be non-conforming or trans-identified, and every interaction with a cop, you're being misgendered or gendered mm-hmm. one way or the other. And their record sheets is literally a hodgepodge of anything that various cops, there's no standard. And even just from the idea that the police don't have standards in how they engage with people is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But that is something that apparently is happening at a conversation at the national level, which is pretty cool. That was news that we were made aware of a couple of weeks ago through the through Ottawa, and we wanted to share it, but I forgot, and I'm glad you reminded me. Yeah, so that's sort of just a random sidebar.
Can I just ask you something? This is just completely out of Please. Nowhere, but it's a non-binary thing, because I was reading about in California, in the California Judiciary Committee, the chairwoman of the committee has switched to in committee proceedings to using only gender neutral pronouns. Is that something that's very mainstream in sort of the non-binary community as like as a goal to aspire to use, like, just for everybody regardless of how they self-identify, just using that as sort of the default?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was on a panel with Ray, and it was really interesting because we were talking about, like, if you don't know someone's pronouns, just use gender neutral pronouns. And then it was really interesting because I was talking to a friend of both of ours, Audrey, and she was like, you know, it's nice to be able to do that, but also you have to, like, also remember that, like, trans folks really, like, want to be seen and, like, don't want to be have gender neutral pronouns a lot of the time. Mm. And, like, there is an erasure in that. And I was like, whoa, yeah, thank you. And, you know, it's been like this learning for me, like, where, you know, Ray and I are like, yeah, we'll just use gender neutral pronouns, we don't know. And then we're also, but then Audrey kind of brings in this other part, and I'm like, great, okay, great.
I think there was an interesting conversation I had about, you know, a whole bunch of, like, much older trans folks who aren't trans, they're women or they're men. And it was, there's a kind of cultural understanding of the time that there's point A and point B, and once you're at point B, you are point B. And there was, the rest of it is behind you, that's it. And to refer to them with some kind of unclarity is almost seen as insulting and, and kind of insinuating that the process isn't completed. And so there's certainly that take within community as well. So, I mean, really the takeaway for our audience here is that there really is no clear path. There's certain things you can say and do to be a bit more accessible, but, you know, there is no, like, style guide on engaging community here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing is just to, like, look at people in the eye and like ask them and invite them to like share by like sharing your own mm-hmm. pronouns. Like, hey, this is what I do. Like, would you like to share too?
I think it's also important to be comfortable with there not being a broad swath right answer to that question, because that's reinforcing another kind of binary, which is mm-hmm. that, okay, if we go from like only using like ladies and gentlemen, she, her, he, him, his pronouns to they, them, theirs, like obviously that's not going to solve a problem for everyone. So it's probably fine that there needs to be a middle ground of being as inclusive as possible. Mm-hmm.
There was a great, I used to do training for the Oral Police Service, and we had a conversation with them where, you know, if you pull somebody over because they're speeding or what have you, and you misidentify or misgender somebody in the car, and they correct you, and really it is your next step that is indicative of whether or not this is going to be a good interaction or not. Is your next step to use the gender pronoun of which you've been corrected, or to continue to misgender them? And it actually reminds me of the Senate committee hearings of Bill C-16, which added gender identity and gender expression to the Canadian Human Rights Code, where they were talking about how it would police language in terms of implying certain languages that has to be used, and misgendering could be counted as harassment. And Wilson Raybould and the top lawyer for Justice Canada said that it's not illegal to use somebody's name. So if ever there's a moment of confusion, their name is totally fine. You know, that's always, and I'm not going to lie, I was in the Senate committee as an audience person at the back, and I nearly burst out laughing because it was one of those like deadpan dark humor moments, and it took all my strength not to laugh at various senators, but it was hilarious.
Just because it was so self-evident.
Yeah, it was like, and the lawyers like leaned in and was like, you could use their name. And it was just like,
you know, what's really interesting in like a lot of non-binary communities, like some people are just like, I don't want pronouns to be used when people refer to me. I just prefer my name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, that's so beautiful. It's like, just call me Katie. And like, that's it. Don't need to use a pronoun.
Yeah. I mean, a good question maybe to pick up on our original conversation point is there something, you know, and this is something that I think is we've spoken to and I've been corrected on, is mm-hmm. there's a sense of an ivory tower element, sort of the town to gown divide on the use of language. And for our listeners' sake here, that is typically within a university environment where, you know, 60-odd people are doing women and gender studies majors. The language and the specialization and the jargon that is developed within those communities isn't the same language that's used in more rural communities. Mm-hmm. So they're not talking from the same, singing from the same prayer book here, or whatever metaphor I've massively mangled. But it's the idea that, is this debate something that's distinct to urban centers, or is this discussion something that we're seeing happening Canada-wide, even in rural communities? What is your interpretation of navigating pronouns being sort of in Canadian communities?
I mean, you know, trans people exist everywhere. So I'd say that wherever people realize that they were assigned a gender at birth that doesn't match their identity as a person coming through puberty and adulthood, that's a conversation that is going to happen in one way or another. And I think it's an interesting and valid point that there are certain aspects of conversations around these issues that get tied up in academic language in a way that is super inaccessible to people who don't have access to secondary, post-secondary education, or maybe haven't spent time trying to gain that education for free on the internet, or don't know that those options exist, etc. There's a bit of a fissure there, but I don't think that, especially because of the way that we're able to connect online at this point, that urban-rural divide is quite as stark as maybe it once was. That said, I'm a cis person, and so I I can't speak for anyone, but that would be my guess.
I think that, you know, we're in a kind of populist political moment right now. And one of the roots of populism is a sort of resentment for elites. And the idea that there is a class divide and an disequilibrium of sort of, you know, economic power in the society. And I think that there is a lot of folks feel very alienated and resentful and disempowered by the feeling that there is a kind of stratified society in which there is an elite that has access through their various privileges and that often come from having access to education and institutional facilities in which they're kind of, you know, informed and educated. And as part of this kind of increasingly knowledge-based society we have, in which the people that have access to the knowledge, access to the quote-unquote right answers, the right vocabulary, you know, this kind of thing, are in a position of great power and great influence. And that I think that there becomes a lot of resentment when that class is seen as not being self-aware of their own privilege and instead being very condescending or very dismissive or being, you know, very, you know, just not having a conciliatory attitude and not being realizing that there is a disequilibrium of power there, which is to say that, like, even though you can be fighting on in your mind, and, you know, I believe accurately, this is an accurate conception, you are fighting on the behalf of the marginalized and the disempowered, but that does not give carte blanche to carry yourself in a condescending attitude. And I think that there is that's something that sort of has to be sorted out in this community, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's along the lines of the point of call-out culture and how that can increase division. At the same time, I don't know that that's a new thing. I think it's just amplified by the internet. And I don't think that conflict means that progress is stunted. Mm-hmm. I think it's really helpful to have discomfort and growing pains within movements, because it's just, there's no way that you can find a homogenous right answer, especially when it comes to identity politics.
Absolutely.
And I was going to say that, you know, yes, the internet is good in that it's allowed, you know, people to share their experiences and to see other experiences. But I've found, I guess that maybe this is from my own experience, until I actually had a friend who was trans and to talk to them as a real human being who I could actually interact with to actually understand what they were going through, I didn't understand at all what they were going through. And, you know, yes, the internet is good because it allows these stories to be told, but it's through it's through that one lens. There's no real interaction. You know, I knew where, you know, I didn't know where my blind spots were until I actually, you know, could delve in and talk through and have a conversation, actually match the experiences that this person was going through with what I think my blind spots were. And so I think, yeah, the internet's good in that it gives us the opportunity, for a lot more information to get out there, but it's still, until someone actually meets someone who is gay or lesbian or trans or non-binary or whatever, they don't, I feel from my experience, they don't really get a true sense of it. And that's why I think it's important to, you know, for people to, you know, go out there and, you know, be themselves in those, in the various communities that they're in, so people can actually get to know who they are as individuals.
That's a thought sort of occurs to me as you're saying that. It's, I agree completely that, you know, it's through exposure and through interaction with people representing different communities that your awareness is broadened and your compassion grows. Part of me is wondering if that is unto itself a form of privilege, though, because if you are in a community, say like you're in a very urban sort of setting such as we are right now, where there's a lot of, you know, very open-minded sort of people, and we have a sort of generous sort of community culture where people can be themselves and be their genuine selves. And as a result of living in that community, you are exposed and able to interact with a great deal of diversity of people. And thus your sort of awareness of them and your understanding of how to navigate these different sorts of relationships is much, much greater than someone who, say, came from a community where people are not comfortable being out with their identities and are not open. You know, you could say that, you know, like I, as somebody who lives in Vancouver, like I've met trans people, I've met non-binary people, I've met all of these people. Therefore, I'm really great because I know how to navigate all these complicated relationships. But someone who comes from, say, a very rural area where people are not out, like, is that person worse off? Can we judge that person more because they have not developed skills that they couldn't realistically have developed just given the different nature of their community?
I spoke with a listener of Can Queer who said that this show is like tuning in and just like listening into your favorite little gay friend from across the country and just like listening in and getting a sense of like, oh, okay, maybe that's what they're thinking. Which is neat, and maybe these conversations gives us a chance to put them out there so you don't have to harangue that one gay guy in the town to get their perspective on anything. Well, we're going to leave it on that wonderful note and jump to the first track of the evening. Now, Glenn, do you want to introduce the first track?
Yes, I will play Crypt Keeper by Devours. Devours is a local Vancouver artist as well. So here it is.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Stuart Smith, and still missing this week is Sebastian. We will continue to look under all rocks, big and small, until we find where he is hiding from us. In the meantime, I am joined by some amazing folks from the BC area. Now, you can catch us at www.canqueer.news. We were talking just before the break about, we started off a general conversation about, is queer culture consistent across Canada? Is it this sort of construct? And really what I took away from that first 20-odd minutes is really there's an agreement on a disagreement, which I feel like is essentially a very Canadian way of saying, eh. So maybe picking up from that indecision, what do you think is there a Canadian queer identity?
That's a very, very difficult question. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I can speak to my own evolution on this, is that I used to think of myself as just, you know, a gay man, and that, you know, I was kind of hostile, I would even say, which I think is not uncommon among some gay men to think that, oh, I've got nothing in common with lesbians, I've got nothing in common with trans people, this LGBT thing is just this contrived, you know, sort of nonsense. But definitely, in the way that certainly in the sort of the rising importance that the trans issues have sort of entered into the mainstream, that has really made me a lot more aware of the idea to which all of these sort of groups are in fact linked in a very real way, and that a lot of the plight and the difficulties that you go through as being a member of sort of the LGBT rainbow is in fact actually quite comparable in a lot of ways. And so I think there is a lot to learn from each other, and there is a lot to self-identify with one another, each other, and a lot of, you know, coalition building that is not at all irrational, but in fact makes perfect sense. So, I mean, like, I think that as you broaden your awareness of other queer communities, I think the alliance seems more natural than I think it necessarily did when you have a more small-minded, more just individualistic approach to this.
I would say it's sort of funny because I think there are very clear divisions in terms of who hangs out with who within queer communities, physically speaking. But ideologically, I've noticed, at least in my own experience in Vancouver, that there's a lot more of, well, at least on the east side, it depends. It's a little bit weird, but there seems to be a little bit more willingness to understand and stand up for issues across the board, like you were just saying, that there's a little bit more camaraderie, I guess, when it comes to standing up for people who don't benefit from things like gay marriage, but are still fighting for gender markers on gift certificates, birth certificates.
That's the next fight.
Yeah. LGBTQ specific gift certificates everywhere. So I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I don't go to a lot of the bars that are more for gay men, but that doesn't mean that I wouldn't stand up for an issue that they were fighting for.
Yeah. It's like interesting for me to like talk about like so-called Canada, because I think for me right now the things that I'm looking at and thinking about are like Indigenous things and like what people of color are doing, and I'm always like looking to what those folks are doing to be like, I just want to prop up those things and like give space to those things. So
yeah, and kind of to what JJ was saying is the, I guess, those linkages between the different groups. You know, I never understood or really could put a word to it, but when somebody explained what intersectionality meant, it was how all of these, you know, how these different experiences, sometimes it feels like they pile up on each other, right? So, you know, I'm a gay Black man, so what are my experiences as a gay man in the Black community and as a Black man in the gay community? And it really made me realize that it was important to support others within this broader community, because there are other challenges. And yeah, as a gay man, you know, there's now certain, you know, rights and privileges that, you know, people talk about equality or whatever, but there's certain things that, you know, I recognize that I've got a little bit more of a, you know, if it's a leg up is the term you want to use, but to really support some of these other communities who, yeah, there's, whether you're gender nonconforming or it's gender identity or gender expression, there's definitely some support that those communities need, just like our community had support as, you know, we were coming up. So I think it's important to lend support. You know, if you talk about, you know, Canadian queer identity, I don't know, because I struggle with trying to answer what's the Canadian identity. I don't know what it is. You know, I grew up in Mississauga, but I live in Vancouver now, and it feels like to the friends I have here, the people in the community here, there's more, you know, North, South, regional, Pacific Northwest community feel than there is any kind of like Toronto, Montreal connection, or Vancouver, Montreal connection. It's tough to kind of put a bow around it and say there's this one Canadian queer thing, because, you know, even Canada, we're really diverse people and all these different regions. It's tough. I don't know if there's a single way to answer that.
Yeah, maybe it was a bit of a red herring and of a question. I feel like there are certain things that all Canadians can agree on, such as the fact that Toronto, last I checked, was still the center of the universe. I think that's I think that may be one of them. But one of the things that occurred to me, and I'm really glad that the conversation from the folks here kind of went in that direction, is there was a story a couple of weeks ago about a go-go dancer in L.A., who had decided that he's now straight, and everybody was questioning his ability to make himself to identify as straight because he still goes to gay clubs and still has sexual intercourse with other men. And they were like, you know, pretty sure when I checked the dictionary, that still counts as gay. And it's this debate as to who, like, how does one define one's own sexuality? And what I thought was really interesting is that hidden within that conversation was sort of a distancing of the word gay and of the culture gay, and kind of tying to that heterosexual privilege and the idea that feminism or being an effeminate gay was something that was less desirable than being a particularly macho gay. And I feel like this I'm now straight debate and whether or not one has to be gay if that's the behavior you're doing, is sort of an evolution of that. As we fought back against no fats, no femmes, no Asians, they're just like, oh, well, in that case, I'm just straight because I can get away with it. And it's the idea of being straight passing, of people not being able to tell that you're gay because you may not have the common cultural markers in what makes somebody stand out as gay. We interviewed a really good friend of the show, Bradley, who runs Queers, Questions, and Cocktails, who doesn't have passing privilege. You can tell from 30 paces that that is a gay man. You know, and I don't think identifying as straight would really do him much help at all. Sorry, Bradley. But, you know, do you think that that's maybe something that a conversation that's happening here, that it's complex and it's hard to police identities, but is it this whole just being used as a... It boils down to passing privilege. So there are certain folks who, you know, gay is one of those things where you may or may not be spotted as being gay. So if you're walking down the street, does somebody look at you and go, that is a gay man? Or do they literally have no idea? And there's a degree of flying under the radar that happens with that. Mm. So there are no fats, no femmes, idea was also the no femmes element was rooted in the idea that it's better to not be seen as gay than to be seen as gay, and it's sort of misogyny and internalized homophobia all tied up into one big awful bundle. And we seem to have moved away from that, which is great, but there's an emerging conversation that started with this go-go dancer that sort of inspired a bit of a debate about, oh, who can identify as straight? And the folks who were starting to identify as straight but doing gay things were straight passing gay guys.
Yeah, and so I've had a little bit of a discussion with friends about this, and it's my view is, you know, we've tried to have all these labels, and it helps to explain a little bit of your sexual orientation or your gender expression and identity. And the label is like, okay, this is the thing. And so you can try and put a person in a box based on this label. But that's, yes, you can, it's a start of an identity, but it's not everything about an individual. And, you know, as on the medical side, if you look at it, you know, they're moving away from using that and they're talking about, you know, instead of saying gay, they say men who have sex with men. And it's not trying to put a label on an identity. And there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot that can be packed into an identity. And people, you talk about internalized homophobia or anything else. And I can, my own story is I struggled with using the word gay because I didn't see other people who looked like me who were gay. And so I couldn't accept this label, but it does describe something. Yeah, I'm a guy who would have sex with other men. So it's a very tough conversation to have because, you know, some people, you know, really put a lot into the label, but others, you know, we're talking about, you know, you're trying to not have a label at all and just, you know what, just using, just calling you Katie instead of having to call you something specific. And I think that's really where, you know, hey, if this was a perfect world, I think that's where we would get to. It'd be a lot less about labels and a little bit more about just, hey, who you are as an individual and what you choose for yourself. You know, mm-hmm. if he wants to call himself straight, okay. You know, other people may disagree with it, but it kind of makes me mad. It pisses me off a little bit, but you know what? That's, you do you.
I mean, don't get me wrong. You're not disagreeing with how the guy identifies. He can identify as anything that strikes their fancy. But my issue is whether or not only certain people have the choice to identify otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, only certain people won't get that identity thrust upon them based on how they look and sort of their cultural markers that they carry about them. And I think that is really the question. You, there's a certain privilege to be like, actually, you know, I don't believe in boxes. Whereas other folks walking down the street, they're going to get hollered at through a car window. And they don't have a choice in the matter. That's going to be thrust upon them. So I think there's certainly a discussion here about, you know, gay identity as a construct and gay identity, which is kind of forced upon certain people, and who has the option of opting out and who doesn't have the option of opting out.
Yeah. I mean, I had straight identity thrust upon me until my early 20s, and everyone assumed I was straight until I said I wasn't. And then they didn't believe me until I had a girlfriend. And now people shout dyke at me out the window of their car as I'm walking down the street with another femme-presenting person. But until that, they just shouted fat. From my perspective, both of those things are rooted in misogyny, and the way that I present based on a haircut or what kind of pants I'm wearing or what, you know, if I have a leather jacket or if I'm wearing makeup or not, those markers are just how I'm flagging to be part of a community of people who can relate to that specific experience of misogyny. But at its root, it was misogyny and remains misogyny. Maybe it's also now homophobia. Great. being seen in that way hasn't changed. And there being violence attached to being a woman and now a gay woman is sucks, but it's still something that is real. And so if people who have experienced homophobia based on being effeminate want to identify as straight, and maybe that is real for them, then I don't understand it, but it's not my business.
Mm-hmm. I think this actually pivots us back really nicely to the conversation overall. And you said that there are certain icons that indicate to folks around you that, you know, you're a lesbian, and it's the haircut, it's certain symbolism that we do to kind of flag to each other. That symbolism seems to be pretty consistent across Canada. There are some distinctly Canadian things that used to exist, such as the hanky code was very popular in Canada, and in Britain we had Polari, which was an entire language that was developed just amongst gay men, you know, which is quite distinctly queer and cultural. And, you know, and there's certainly other iconography that is uniquely queer in terms of its use. In terms of that way, in that understanding, then, is there something that's distinctly Canadian, or is how we understand markers to flag up that we're queer actually something that's universal to the States and sort of this generic Western construct of homosexuals?
Well, Canada and the United States are part of a common civilizational cultural entity, I think, in many ways. I mean, I do think, though, that one of the points that was raised is that, you know, I do think that there has been some penetration of sort of Aboriginal gender and sexuality awareness in this country that has become quite acute and quite visible. I mean, the degree that we speak of two-spirited people now, I think, is something that is quite distinct, and that has become a very entrenched way in the fact that you see a lot of people, you know, I grew up using LGBT, but, you know, now a lot of people say LGBTQ2 in acknowledgement of two-spirited people. So that's sort of something that's very distinctive. Whether or not that is relatable to the vast majority of Canadians as anything beyond, you know, a sort of virtue signal political statement as I think a much more open question. And you could say, to what degree has sort of Indigenous gender and sexuality awareness sort of permeated the mainstream? I don't know, but that was sort of something that just popped into my mind, is something that I guess is distinctly Canadian in a way, as via, you know, America or Europe or somewhere else where this, you know, is perhaps less present.
So we're gonna jump to a song.
Absolutely. I think this will go well with where I think we're gonna take this conversation. The song is I'm Afraid of Men by Vivek Shraya.
In my house, don't even turn the lights on, cause I shine so bright. But when I open the door, my glow starts to fade, cause I'm afraid. Checking my shoulder, my feet hurt from walking faster. Are you hitting on me? Are you hitting on me? Or are you gonna hit me? In my room, don't even have my clothes on, cause my body's free. But when I leave my space, layers to dissuade, cause I'm afraid. My chest hurts from folding over, my back hurts from shrinking smaller. Are you hitting on me? Are you hitting on me? Or are you gonna hit me?
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Stilu. We've been having a really interesting conversation about queer identity and whether or not there is a common Canadian queer identity or not. We had planned to talk about Gillette, which would have beautifully tied in with that song, but I want to keep up the conversation around the gay identity. And I think what I wanted to take it is about the fact that you mentioned two-spirited and how that's been kind of folded into the politically correct terminology that's being used. By the way, I always find it hilarious when people are like, is it LGBT, LGBTQ2? And in one of the training sessions I did, I actually wrote down every acronym that was currently available and used by folks in Canada, and it was like 40 letters long. There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't get the latest memo, you're terribly out of date. Yeah, so it's a bit of a challenge. It's certainly a challenge to keep up. And how does one keep up? What if I say the wrong thing? There are some listeners going, oh my gosh, it keeps dropping the word queer. How, you know, that's so triggering and so awful. And we do acknowledge that, of course, some folks had the word queer used as a weapon against them. But, you know, essentially, we just had to pick a name, and it rolled off the tongue. So that's pretty much why we did. But what I wanted to talk about is how what is constructed as gay and what is more commonly understood as the behavior, they don't necessarily correlate. So there's culturally gay, and then there's the things that you do behind closed doors in bedrooms or various other rooms or small tiny closets if you're downtown Vancouver, based on the house prices. But the what you do behind doors and what you culturally identify as may not match up, that are distinctly queer. There is a legacy of our history that is uniquely gay and queer. There was a New York Times reporter who did a study, who did an in-depth look at the culture amongst folks who are deaf. and they have a distinct language amongst each other. They have idols, they have leaders, they have entertainment and art and history that is unique to each other, that they share amongst each other in a horizontal way, that it's peer-to-peer culture exchange. And that is very much where queer culture comes from. You know, avoid such a bar. It's a bit of a skeezy location. Or, you know, maybe in your room, use things like gender-neutral pronouns. And these sort of these tips and tricks that help us identify each other and identify spaces and history that is distinct to our identity has nothing to do with who we're under the sheets with, but more to do with that sort of shared identity that sort of overrides that. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran said there's no gays in Iran, and I think he was referring to like the Western idea of a gay man, and I think he's right, that cultural identity didn't exist there. What's your take on that sort of summary of it? Because, like, I mean, I obviously have opinions on this.
Well, I've just been thinking about, like, okay, I'm an AFAB person, but I'm non-binary, and we were talking about the word queer, and, like, I love that word, and it feels really empowering for me, but, like, even if I, for instance, decided to date a cis man, I would still be in a queer relationship because I am a non-binary person, and, like, no matter what gender I decide to, like, have sex with, it will always be queer because I'm in it. And it's really interesting because, you know, I have had, like, you know, I'm, like, currently dating this beautiful woman and I love her very much, and, you know, there was this point in our relationship where she's like, oh, how many queer people have you been with before? And I'm like, what? Like, what is that? What are you asking me? And then she didn't realize that she was kind of, like, policing the, like, interactions that I had. And I, like, explained this to her and she was like, oh, right. Like, I'm a cis woman. And, like, for me to say that, like, only the times when you've been with, like, cis women are, like, the only queer interactions that you've had was, like, you know, she was like, oh, sorry, like, and, you know, it was really important conversation. It was also really hard, but it's been really good since we've had that conversation, so.
Yeah, something that I was thinking about as you were talking about, And it's difficult to talk about because the words that we have to describe all of these different ideas, as well as sexual interaction, as well as communities, are imperfect and always changing. And I studied history at school and at university, and even understandings of words like lesbian or gay didn't mean those things until fairly recently in terms of human history. So it's not to say that those sexual acts and these sets of feelings that are different from quote-unquote normal sexual interaction, it's not to say that they didn't exist or happen. It's just that we didn't have the same language for it, and we didn't have the same point to rally around based on that language. So I think it's good that it's always in flux and confusing, because that's never going to stop changing. It's never going to stop evolving as long as we have more people who are feeling comfortable coming into communicating about the fact that, you know, for example, you, Katie, saying every relationship that I've been in is queer because I am queer. That's probably not a thought that has always been, you know, people haven't always been able to articulate that. And that's great.
Yeah, no, that's that's a lot to think about. And I mean, this is what's good about having conversations like this, is that they are genuinely thought-provoking and that they make you sort of frame issues in different ways. I mean, I guess a lot of it just comes back to, in response to what you were saying initially, is what was coming into my mind when you were articulating this is just the concept of being othered, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, I suppose, is just the broad thing that unites the community, is that we're all people that have some experience of being othered in some form or another. But, you know, that is obviously not exclusionary to people that have gender or sexual identities. I mean, it's obviously, that's what intersectionality teaches us, is that we all live elaborate lives and that we're, you know, othered in multitude of different ways, some of which are overlapping, and, you know, some of which, you know, we have some identities that are privileged and some that are not. And I don't know, it's a very rich and complicated topic, I guess, and that's kind of an imperfect answer, but I mean, all you can really do is try to intellectually talk through some of these things and realize as well that you're never going to come to a clean answer, because that's not what life is, right? Like, mm-hmm. life is not a game in which you get the correct answer in Jeopardy and you win all the points, right? Life is kind of just a long struggle of just trying to make things work and muddling through.
It's messy, complicated, and typically sticky. Did you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, and it really, you know, I think I talked a little bit about it earlier, but it's about, again, labels versus experiences a little, and I'm, you know, I'll use the word queer as an example. Like, I'm okay with that kind of a catch-all for the community, whereas I know, as you said, that there's a lot of people who can't use that because it has painful connotations, and it was a slur, and it was meant to other. And I think it's, you know, in today's, you know, in the younger generations, it's not used as such. And I'm okay with using that to, again, have some camaraderie with those who are bisexual or pansexual or, you know, gender non-binary or whatever in the community. But it's tough, and it's a really complex issue, and I don't really know if there's any one answer or way to describe it. But you know, eventually moving past labels and being able to just share experiences is really what should be important.
Absolutely, and I think if anybody can really take away from this conversation is that really, you know, we've got like five queer people around the table here, and we have, I think we are leaving the table more confused about what is queer identity than
when we didn't define it, Luke?
No,
we don't solve the issue.
The Oxford Dictionary just tuned in to see what they should write next year. And
I mean, they could just transcribe what we said and like go from there.
Here's a bit of a challenge to our listeners. Tweet us at TalkCanQueer if you think you have the go-to definition of queer identity. I think it would be rather entertaining to see what comes out of that. But
spoiler alert, someone will think you're wrong.
That's so true. Well, I want to thank you all for joining us in a broad, wide-ranging conversation that really, if anything, fleshed out that our community is amazing, beautiful, diverse. It's not a homogenous painted brush that we're all the same. Canadian queer identity maybe can be defined as being indefinable, that it is too much of a complex mass of other stuff, that it's really hard to paint it with one little brush.
Which, intersectional.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is all we have time for. We have run out of time. Next week, we are doing our 101 episode, as it is our 100th and... Is it 101st? 101st? I was really wondering what that word would be. It's our 101 episode after our 100th episode. And if you have ever had a question of, I wonder what X means, or why do they keep mentioning this? I have no idea what he's talking about. Hopefully me and Sebastian can provide some clarity, or if this episode was any indication, much, much more confusion. Let us know. Tweet us at TalkCanQueer. I want to thank my guests again for a fantastic conversation. You can follow them all on their respective channels. I'm not sure if folks want to let you know where to follow them.
If you just search for my name on YouTube, you can find my videos, JJ McCullough. Or if I'm sure you just punch that in the Google machine, you'll find lots of people hating me and possibly some good things that I've done as well. So,
yeah, tune in to In Rainbows on CFUV, CFUV.ca.
If you want to follow me on Twitter for lukewarm takes at best, it's at M. Jean Taylor.
And you can listen to Out and About in Canada on CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver.
Excellent. And all of these contact details will be on our website, www.canqueer.news. And we'll be back next week, same time, same place. And we're playing out with...
We're playing out with Sad Song by Hans Moll.
Bitter Excellent. Herb.
Thanks for listening.
The closest mix that I could make to the lavender in my mind. Yeah. But as a whole,